So I'm delighted that our first speaker for 2023 will be Anirban Roy. So Anirban is currently a postdoc at Cornell, working with Nick Battaglia, and he got his PhD from CISA in 2019. So he's broadly interested in topics related to the cosmic microwave background, large-scale structure, and intensity mapping. And in his talk today, he'll be telling us all about probing, reionization, and structure formation with CMB and multi-line intensity mapping. So please go ahead and Anirban, whenever you're ready.
Just a little. Okay, so thank you very much, Neil, Kendrick, and Latham for inviting me, and I'm very pleased to talk to you about all the works that I've been working last 2-3 years. Unfortunately, I could not be there, and these works are actually product of collaborations with some people, particularly Nick Battaglia and my supervisor David Spargel and Carlo Bacigalupi. But I just want to also apologize that I am a little bit sick due to the weather change between Ithaca and my hometown in India. So my voice is a little bit distorted, like cosmic microwave background, and I may cough a couple of times. So I just apologize beforehand due to the flu. So today I'll be talking about reionization and structure formation by using two probes, CMB and line intensity mapping. Now let me just disk. So probably you have seen this picture many times, the chronology of the different processes happening in the universe, but just let me try to describe it in a different fashion in the context of my talk. So we know the cosmic microwave background that probes the baby picture of the universe when the age of the universe was around 380,000 years old. Before that, universe was kind of thermal soup with the elementary particles, electron, proton, neutron, dark matter, and photon. Now, as the universe expanded, the thermal temperature went down below the binding energy of the hydrogen atom. So proton and electron formed hydrogen atom, and there are no more free electrons to scatter those photons. And after the recombination, those photons became free. So when we observe the CMB photons, we are observing actually the last scattering surface. But then the universe was kind of boring. There are a few components. The main components are dark matter and the photon, which is cosmic microwave background photon. And at the latter time, when the age of the universe became a few hundred million years old, then the first generation of stars and galaxies were formed, and they produce high energy photons. And those high energy photons ionize the sea of neutral hydrogen, and universe became ionized. And those epochs, we can observe using different lines, such as 21 centimeter and Lyman alpha line. And what we see at late time by using galaxy surveys, that how the galaxies are distributed, their number density, and so on, which proves the nonlinear universe at latter time. Now, one simple question I can ask, that how could CMB be used to prove the late time universe? Of course, the primordial features of the universe has its distinct signature in cosmic microwave background anisotropies. But what I'm interested in, that as those CMB photons are passing through the structures that formed at latter time, and those primordial CMB photons are modulated by the late time structure formation, how I can probe those modulations to understand the late time universe. And another thing, the complementary thing comes, that if I want to probe the primordial universe as those CMB photons are getting distorted by late time events, then how these late time events can cause problems to understand the primordial universe. Now, let me just summarize what we know so far about the cosmic reionization. So we have different measurements from cosmic microwave background. We measure the tau distinctly from E-mode power spectra, but in principle, we can measure it from all 4 power spectrum. And the present value of tau is 0.054 plus minus 0.06, and so on. Now, if I want to construct a reionization history, then what can I do? That I can consider a 10H-like reionization history that we typically assume with two free parameters, that is the redshift of reionization and the width of duration of reionization. And there are other data set, such as the Quasar Near Zone observation and Lyman Alpha data. Now, if I want to match the varieties of data set and want to come up with a reionization history that I can get from this blue solid line, which is done using the Seyroot simulation that matches these varieties of data set. And if I put it in the context that what it is telling me that reionization is delayed. So we have constant on the second half of the reionization and it roughly ends between redshift 5 to 6. Now, this effect of reionization on CMB has an integrated effect. So we have the only single quantity that we measure is tau. Now the question comes that can we go beyond this value of tau and can we know more about the reionization along with the redshift and the duration of reionization? So in the rest of my talk, I'll basically...
Sorry, can I ask you a question?
Yeah. Sure.
Why is your XE going above 1?
Oh, because we are considering the helium reionization as well at 2.3 or 4. So it is 8% almost. So it just adds up.
So what is the definition of XE?
So it is the number of electron divided by number of hydrogen atom. So number of electrons are increased because of the electron from helium atom is also adding.
Cool, thanks.
Okay, welcome. So now what I'll talk about that how we can go beyond this tau value. So one is that we can use the CMB, as I said, but in this rest of my talk, I'll try to convince that we can do much better going beyond the tau by using the high sensitive and high resolution and low noise CMB experiments. So CMB takes into account the global properties of reionization. It cannot resolve the individual sources or basically the astrophysics that is related to a particular galaxy. It has the global imprint on the CMB power spectra. So small scale CMB fluctuation can unveil many properties of reionization, but whereas multi-layer intensity mapping that probes the intensities, we don't need to resolve the individual galaxies, but we can kind of capture the intensities that are coming from a few galaxies altogether, and it depends on the resolution of an experiment, and we can try to probe the spatial distribution of those intensities. For line intensity map, we can actually do the local properties of reionization. For example, how the galaxies can ionize, how the galaxies can form the ionized bubble, the ISM physics, escape fraction, and so on. And in second part of my talk, I'll talk more in details that how line intensity mapping can be used to probe the reionization epoch and also the post-reionization epoch. Now, just let me talk about little bit just what is patchy reionization. So as the underlying density field is, inhomogeneous, so they will form the sources inhomogeneously. And so due to this inhomogeneity, the sources, there will be different source densities at different line of sight. And as the high energy sources form the ionized bubble, they march with each other as time passes and the universe become ionized. Now, when the CMB photons, they scatter by this hot electron gas present in the ionized bubbles, there are a few effects. One is that as they have they have free electrons, so they have an optical depth. So the overall CMB will be screened by e to the power minus tau factor. And those free electrons will also scatter those CMB photon. And along with these effects, as those ionized bubble will have radial peculiar velocity, so it will have the additional Doppler boost, which is kinetic Soon-Abelson-Lovich effect. Now, traditionally, what we do, we measure one single quantity, which is the value of tau, that depend on the power spectra, the amplitude of power spectra and shape also. Now, as the inhomogeneity in the electron density, so now tau, the optical depth, will be function of different line of sight. So now I can write it in terms of the ionization fraction and a perturbation on ionization fraction, which can be transferred to delta N, number density of fluctuation in electron density. Now the question is that, can we probe this fluctuation in optical depth or not by using upcoming CMB experiments? Now, of course, to understand, we need to kind of understand the complex nature of the ionization process, particularly the morphology, which is very hard to model, lack of data set from the ionization epoch. So I'm just showing that let's consider a toy model. So I consider that before the universe become fully ionized, there are distribution of shapes in ionized, there is distribution of shapes in ionized bubble. So, and they follow a log normal distribution. It is kind of consistent with the semi-numerical simulations. Of course, I can do it more sophisticatedly. I can use the excursion state principle or even the radiative transfer simulation. But there, it is hard to infer the shape of the ionized bubbles because they are not spherical in nature. But let's first consider that we are considering a toy model where I have two free parameters. One is the characteristic size of ionized bubbles, and one is the spread of the ionized bubble that is in the log normal distribution. So if I increase the value of R bar, it means I am expecting larger bubble sizes. And if I increase the sigma LNR, it means I'm changing the width of the distribution to a larger value. It means I expect that more and more large bubble sizes as well. Now, when I kind of set up this kind of framework of the morphology of reionization by using this toy model, what we do always, we want to calculate the power spectra. So what will be the theoretical prediction of the tau power spectra? What is the anisotropies in the tau fluctuation? So just to tell that CL tau tau is a reconstructed signal. We cannot observe it. So it has its imprints in the CMB sky, and it can be written with the morphology of reionization, which is PXCXC, the power spectra in ionization fraction. And all the astrophysical aspects of reionization is encoded in PXCXC. You can think it as CL tau tau as kind of the lensing potential field that modulates the primordial CMB and power spectra by introducing non-Gaussianity. Now, what we want to do, we want to see that if we can reconstruct the CL tau tau by using this toy model, and we can see that if we want to, if we can measure this CL tau tau power spectra. Besides, also as those CMB photons will be scattered by free electron density, there will be additional B-mode signal due to the scattering, which is CLBB. And this is a real signal, which means that if, let's say, I have different models of reionization, I can actually, for a particular reionization model, I can understand that what will be the CL B-mode signal coming due to the reionization, something like lensing B-mode signal, or so this is B-mode signal coming due to the reionization epoch. Now, why we are interested in optical depth map? Just let me present an analogous comparison that, for example, it is CMB lensing potential map, which shows the projected matter density field, which is remarkable. And signal to noise ratio was very low for Planck, but now we have the high resolution lensing potential map. Same way we want to create, if I can make a map of tau, it will act as an electron density template of the universe. And this optical depth map will capture information from reionization clusters and diffuse sources. And also we have other probes to understand. For example, the reionization, patchy reionization epoch can be understood by observing KSG signal. Means in principle, clusters and diffuse sources have also imprints on Compton Y parameter, which I'll talk in a while. Now, that's why we are interested in the optical depth map, that if we can make a map, we expect that this will correlate with the lensing potential map. The reason is that where I have more matter, I'll expect there will be more sources, and they will ionize the neutral medium accordingly. Now, just to show our prediction, which is based on this very toy model. So here I fix the tau. It means I have fixed the reionization history. And then I am changing the bubble sizes. So let's say green line is for 10 megaparsec, blue line is for 7 megaparsec, and so on. Now, as I increase the value of R, it means I am generating more and more larger bubble. So the peak will be shifted to the low L, so the larger scale. And at high L, the error bars are pretty large. The reason is that the beam of CMB experiment exponentially increases at those scales. And at low L also, I have the signal is very low. Now, different groups have worked on it, and the forecast typically, as you can see, that this depends on the morphology of reionization. But what we have predicted that a CMB is for like experiments will be able to detect more than 10 sigma confidence level based on variety, like it depends on the model, but still the forecasts are around 10 sigma or more or so on. And all the values of R bar and tau that are consistent also with the observation or either the prediction from the numerical and radiative transfer simulations of reionization. So just to show that how it will look schematically, that if you want to reconstruct a tau, so in first row, I fixed the value of R bar and I'm changing the value of tau. So if I increase the value of tau, it means I'm generating more and more free electrons along the line of sight of CMB. So the intensity of the tau map will increase because I'm generating more and more free electron density. In bottom panel, what I'm doing that I fix the reionization history. So I know that when reionization started and when it ended, then I'm changing the value of R bar, which is 5 megaparsec, 7 megaparsec, 10 megaparsec. It means that I can see that the patches, the size of the patches are increasing because I'm increasing the bubble sizes. Now the aim is to see that if we can reconstruct one of these maps by using the CMB observations. Now, as I said, that there will be also secondary B-mode signal due to patchy reionization. So what I want to ask, we asked actually the question that if the secondary B-mode signal coming from reionization, is it possible that this secondary B-mode signal from reionization can contaminate the primordial B-mode signal? And at that time, when I started this project in 2019 or 18, we didn't know that what will be the exact amplitude based on the present knowledge on reionization. So here in dashed line, I'm showing that lensed B-mode power spectra corresponds to R is equal to 10 to the power minus 3. And these are the error bar from different experiments. And as I don't know, though, as there are no observations of primordial B-mode signal, I'm showing three primordial B-mode signal. The aim is to either observe around reionization bump at low L or the around L is equal to 100, the primordial B-mode signal. And these are the instrumental noise curves from that I inferred from different experiments, Simon Observatory, CMBS4, PICO, or so on. Now, if we use a semi-analytical model, I can see this shaded region is the reionization-induced B-mode based on this toy model. And the width of this shaded region is based on the one sigma error bar on tau. Now, the question is that, can I trust this model or not? So then what we did, rather than using this toy model, I used a radiative transfer simulation, which is a little bit, which is expensive to perform. But I used the output of that radiative transfer simulation. And what we have found this red solid line. So it shows that, okay, even by I can see that if the value of R goes below 10 to the power minus, if value of the R is larger than 10 to the power minus 3, the reionization induced B mode is not important. So if it was one order of magnitude larger, then like we do delensing to get rid of the lensing signal to recover the primordial B mode signal, we need to do something dereionizing just to remove the secondary B-mode signal from reionization. And there are other groups also, like Mukherjee et al. They also computed this B-mode signal by using different method, and it kind of agrees quite well at low L because they did not have better resolution to get the small scale effects on B-mode. We did analysis that what will be the delta R, what will be the bias on R due to the reionization. So let's consider there is no foreground. So what if I have the secondary B-mode signal on the primordial B-mode signal, what will be the bias delta R on the R of the primordial B-mode signal? So here, if there is no bias in x-axis, the value of R will be the same at y-axis. So R effective will be R because there is no bias. Now, if I consider different reionization model that varies with different M mean, I can see that even at 10 to the power minus 3, if I consider the minimum mass of the mass of the ionizing sources at 10 to the power 11, then it can bias around 10% and so on. Of course, it is worse if I go to 10 to the power minus 4, but of course that is out of scope of all the planned CMB experiments, because the best measurement of R we can do is around 10 to sigma R is just few into 10 to the power minus 3. Now the thing is that okay, what else we can do using the CMB dataset? So as we can expect, that those ionized bubble also have the temperature, which is TB. And so it means that they have also pressure, which is any TB. And also we have low redshift objects, clusters. They also have pressure, which when we have a Compton map, they are basically dominated by the Compton Y parameter that are coming from the halos. Now, if I do a quantitative measurement, the tau value of reionization is little bit larger than the tau value of galaxy clusters, but the temperature of galaxy clusters are much larger than the temperature of ionized bubbles during reionization. So CL tau tau from reionization is larger than CL tau tau that we find in halos, but CL YY from reionization is 3 to 4 order of magnitude subdominant than the CLY of halos. Now, what we ask that, okay, if we cross-correlate these two different observations, different probes actually, so we have tau and we have Compton Y parameter. So if I cross-correlate these two things, CL tau Y, can we measure this tau Y parameter power spectra by using Planck data, or even just forecast for the future experiments?
Sorry, sure. Can you go back to the previous slide? Yes, sorry, the one before. Let's see. I guess the question I'm trying to figure out is, is patchy reionization the main problem for measuring R, or is it the lensing, CMB lensing?
So just to show, you can see this green curve. So green. Mm-hmm. So if I don't do delens, let's say I have only lensing signal. So you can see the how much delta R it can cause, basically this. So I need to delens it to get rid of the lensing signal. So lensing signal is the biggest problem.
But this delensing, I mean, will it be perfect? I mean, it still would be something left, wouldn't there?
Exactly. So the CMBS, in CMBS for science book, they claim that they can delens around 80%, 80 to 90%. But again, I'll be a little bit skeptical, but 90% is probably a little bit optimistic number, but they expect to do it around 80%.
Okay, by combining. Yes, it's still much bigger than this, right? Or am I right?
Yes, even I do 80% delensing, probably I'll get somewhere here. I don't know if I can show. Okay. So the lensing signal is, I mean, if you ask that what is the main problem, then the first problem comes the foreground, the dust quantum. But Even let's say I can remove 100% dust, BMOD signal from dust, then main challenge is to how we can do delays, even 80%.
Okay, thank you.
And okay. So what we did that we used Planck temperature map. We actually, in theory, we can show that EB estimator works well, but we could not use polarization data because the polarization data of Planck is very, very noisy. So we gain anything. And it's kind of noisy for this kind of estimators. So what we did, and just to mention that these estimators were first devised by Professor Cora Dorkin and Kendrick Smith. So when I started my PhD project, the first paper I read was Kendrick and Cora's paper on reconstructing patch reionization from cosmic microwave background anisotropies. So I had to go through basically all these calculations at that time. But the good thing is that first time we apply it on the Planck data. And this analysis is mainly done by Toshi and Amikawa. So what we did that we considered that the estimator given by Cora Dorkin and Kendrick Smith, which is based on kind of quadratic estimator that we apply for in the lensing on lensing map to reconstruct the CL5-5. So this gray points are actually by using this quadratic estimator of tau. And then we cross-correlate with the Compton Y parameter. But the problem is there can be leakage from lensing to this tau field as non-Gaussianity can be introduced in both fields. So then what we did, we applied a bias hardening estimator, which basically takes into account three fields altogether. So one is lensing field, one is tau field, and one is point source field. And then we try to construct an optimal estimator that can take care into three things so that we can minimize the variance. And as you can see that if I do only lens bias hardening and source bias hardening, it doesn't change much, but it changes from the quadratic estimator to the bias hardening. Now, of course, the data is noisy. We cannot claim something big based on this low signal to noise ratio measurement. But even you can see this plot by eyes, we can see that there is some signal between, let's say, 250, L is equal to 250 to 700 or so on. So what we did that as there are no constants so far from CMB observations, we tried to match the model just to understand that if we can fit some of the parameters with this measurement, and if we can say something about the either the size of the ionized bubble or the temperature of ionized bubble. So this is the first constraints that
So on the previous slide, can I just understand something? Like, you know, so in your expression on the previous slide for CL. I thought you said before that the Y fluctuations mostly come from big halos. Wasn't that the case?
Exactly. So we have to fit the low redshift contribution and the reionization contribution. So that I'll talk here basically this. So CL tau. So I have basically when I'm constructing CL tau Y total, that has contributions both from reionization tau Y and also the tau y from the halos. Mm-hmm. So when I'm fitting this parameter, I am actually taking care of these two components. And I'm going to explain that how we are doing this.
Okay, great. Thanks, John.
Okay. So of course, when I'm getting the total as CMB has an integrated effect, all the processes, of course, the main question we were worried about that probably it is dominated by the low redshift contributions. So what we did that we took a template, the CL tau y from halos that is that we took from simulations in Battaglia 2016 paper that matches with TSG measurements and so on, basically using the gas physics of halos. We tried to take, we took a template of CL tau y of halos. But of course, I don't know that how it can vary. because it can depend if I change the halo mass, minimum mass of the halos, and if I change the gas strophysics, it can change, of course. So just to be a little bit skeptical, what we did, we multiplied with a normalization factor. So if alpha value of alpha is one, it means the template is same as the template I'm using from Patalia's profile. If the alpha prefers 0.1, it means I'm taking the 10% Patalia's template. Or if it is 10, it means 10 times larger value than the template I'm taking. So what we did, we have two contributions and we run the MCMC chain based on this signal that we reconstructed from the Planck data set. And I have the value of alpha. So of course, the main four parameters are the RB, which is the characteristic radius of the ionized bubble, sigma and log temperature, and alpha. So you can see alpha is preferring slightly larger value. But again, we are not getting the lows due to the large error bar. We are not getting much from the small scale CMB information from small scale due to the larger error bar. But the interesting parameter, of course, this is the first constraint from CMB on the value of R bar, even the first measurements on the R bar and sigma. There are constants from Lyman alpha data on the log TB. Now, what is interesting here is that the value I am getting from this analysis is 10 to the power Q into 10 to the power 5, so 6 into 10 to the power 5 Kelvin, which is pretty large, because to make the neutral hydrogen ionized, the minimum temperature we expect, which is the hydrogen cooling curve, temperature, low value of hydrogen cooling curve, which is 2 into 10 to the power 4 Kelvin. But here I am getting all more than one order of magnitude larger temperature. That is not, that of course, 2 sigma upper limit I'm putting here, that is fine, but this is not comparable with the constant that we get from Lyman alpha data set. Now, again, we can understand that why I'm getting large error bar, because the signal to noise ratio is not pretty high. So I cannot basically constrain the temperature, the error bar is pretty much larger. So what we did, we forecasted for the future CMB experiments.
What you were showing, what data set was this so far?
This measurement, Planck data set. So I am fitting.
This is just Planck.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Is there some easy way to understand why these two contributions aren't degenerate with each other?
They are actually degenerate with each other. Actually, probably I don't have a lot. So the thing is that actually it is pretty degenerate in a sense that you can see this. We try to investigate this kind of double peaks here, which is a little bit weird in a sense that, in a sense, the reason is that alpha doesn't depend on reionization at all. So if I change the different value of R, sigma, and log TB, only this term changes, which is CL tau y from reionization, but not the halos. So it is kind of pretty scaling. So this alpha value is not very, of course, when I'm running the chains, of course, I can always take the mean and the sigma, but it doesn't say much in a sense that it doesn't measure the value of alpha. So it would be easier to comment on this if I could see that alpha value is 6.3 plus minus 2 point something. So then I can tell that which alpha value it is preferring. Just because the template has complete different shape than the CL tau y from reionization signal, it's pretty degenerate in that sense. So it can just prefer the value on the amplitude, not the shape of the CL tau y from halos.
Okay, I see. All right, thanks.
Let me just go back. So now these things we are forecasting for future CMB experiments. Now you can ask that what are the prospects of PICO? We don't know it will be funded or not, but the science here is that the PICO sensitivity is 0.6 microkelvin arc minute. So for tau reconstruction, the signal to noise ratio improves if I increase the sensitivity of a telescope. So that's why we have taken one Pico-like experiments where I can reconstruct the tau map very well. And then I am basically combining with the Y map from different experiments. Now, if we see if we take a reference frame like HD cross Pico, the constant is pretty well. And we expect if we can do this at that regime, it will be very interesting to compare this constant with the other constant that are coming from other probes. And the reason is simple as that if we have Lyman alpha data or quasar near observation, there are very few beyond redshift 6. So I have, let's say 10 quasars, and by kind of modeling, I am trying to probe the global properties of reionization. Whereas in CMB, even there are maybe less electrons, but they are scattering the CMB photons. So it will be interesting to basically check just to compare the local properties of reionization with the global properties. And also, I am not an expert, but just to comment on this, that we know that what will be the lowest temperature of the bubbles due to the reionization, but it can go as high as one in principle. So there is no upper limit on that, in a sense that if some weird physics happened, such as dark matter annihilation or something, the temperature can rise up there. Even it can get cooled if there are some scattering between baryonic component and dark matter component. So it is interesting for me because of this region that I'll be able to compare different probes and try to see that if there are any discrepancies. Now, last thing in this section is that, okay, now what if I forget everything about high redshift reionization, but if I want to constrain some of the properties related to the halos? So of course, as they have tau and they have, the halos have also Y, and can we cross-correlate these different quantities to understand the thermodynamic properties of reionization? So what we did the same thing by using this halo model written. This code is written by me, SecPy, and we can by using this halo model, we can generate different quantities, kind of tau field, Y field for halos. So first here, I'm showing that how these different, how the amplitude of CL tau will vary if I change the minimum mass of the halos. So I am just doing 10 to the power 11 to 10 to the power 14. And I can see that the how signal to noise ratio changes. It is 2 to 4 or so on. Now, as LSST, Vera Rubin Observatory-like experiments will probe galaxies, a large number of galaxies. So the question is, what if I have a tau map, and then I cross-correlate this tau map with the galaxy catalog, which is tau g. And the signal-to-noise ratio is again pretty promising because there are a large number of galaxies, and we expect that this will correlate with the galaxy field very well. And the same thing we have done for the tau y signal. And these are all for the halos. And then what we want to do, that if we have these kind of measurements, can we constrain the thermodynamic properties? Basically, if we can measure the pressure profile of halos or the electron density profile, and so on. Just to show the constraint, so we have few free parameters. Of course, I can make free many parameters related to the model. So here I have taken this Battaglia's 26 electron density profile and Battaglia 2012 pressure profile. There I have p parameters. One is that density amplitude of the density profile and amplitude and the shape information of the pressure profile and the HOD model, because I need to populate the galaxies in a halo. Now, HOD profiles can be constant very well only from the galaxy power spectra. If I just consider only the galaxy power spectra that we'll be able to get from LSST like our Vela Rubin like observatories. But the thing is that can we probe all together? So here I'm doing a joint analysis by including tau G plus GG, tau YG plus GG, tau YYG, and so on. And it shows that we can say something about the A rho, which is the amplitude of the density, And if we can do this, that will be also interesting for me because we always measure the integrated pressure profile from PSG measurements, but that is also multiplication factor, that is also multiplied by temperature times the number density of electron. But if we have an independent probes like tau G, we can try to break degeneracies between Ne and T. And of course, we tried, we converted it to the gas mass fraction. Of course, this is based on a model dependent quantity that how I define the radius of a halo. So if I change the radius, of course, the constant will be changed because I'm considering the larger halo. And it shows that we can constant the gas mass fraction at the 7% level and so on. Now, this analysis is important in a sense that there's a missing baryon problem, so we don't see the baryons in the halos. So there are different hypotheses. One is that probably those halos are not illuminating light or illuminating photons, so we cannot observe it directly, but probably they are sitting there. So if the CMB photons are getting scattered by those baryons in halos, or probably they are outside the halos, then this should be captured. If signal to noise ratio is high enough, this will be captured in this whole analysis. And that is the main motivation of this work, just to see that if we can cross correlate different probes and we can kind of break the degeneracies. And particularly this will be also important that in KSG like measurements where we have degeneracy with velocity and tau. So if I have independent constant on value of tau from low redshift, it will be also helpful in that sense. Again, it depends on how well we can measure using the future CMB experiments. Now I have come. Now I'll go to the second part of my talk, which is multi-line intensity mapping, which is different than the CMB observations in a sense that the survey volume is very, very small. Its sky fraction is around, the survey area is 16 degrees square or so on. So just to tell you a little bit about what is multi-line intensity mapping. So now we have galaxies at several redshift, and they have different atoms and molecules inside those galaxies. Now, due to the production of high energy photon, they will ionize these atoms or molecules. So there are different atoms and molecules, for example, carbon monoxide, oxygen, and so on. Now, theoretically, we can see that which lines are bright or not. So the main interest are C2 line and also CO lines. So different, as CO is a molecule, so there will be different transition between the rotational energy, so different J value. So I can have, in principle, CO J1 to 0, J2 to 1, till J13 to 12, or so on. Now, in this plot, what I'm showing, this plot is particularly interesting for me because this plot shows that how different lines coming from different frequencies can be redshifted and fall into the same observational frequency. So let's consider this this yellow solid line, which is 220 gigahertz. Now, if I look along this line, I can see that all these lines that are intersecting this 220 gigahertz frequency, I will receive those lines coming from this different redshift. For example, this C2 line, which is this maroon solid, thick solid line, if I set the observational frequency of my telescope 220, I am getting the C2 signal around from redshift 7.6 or so on. Same, I can say the oxygen 3, which is around 14.5. But again, I have also the low redshift CO, different CO transitions. Same for other frequencies, I am observing, let's say if I consider 4110, I am observing the C2 from 3.6 and so on. Now the aim is to by using different frequencies, actually they are not discrete for C cat prime. We can change, it's kind of a Fabry-Perot interferometer. So by changing its characteristic length, I can scan from 220 to 4110. It means if I consider only one line C2, I can scan the universe from redshift 3.6 to 7.6 by using this C2 line. Same of course, there can be other lines as I'm showing here. Now, first question is that, as it is a new probe, can we detect the C2 from high redshift or not? And if we can detect the C2 signal from high redshift, can we make a map of C2 emission from the at different redshifts or not? So as you can understand, that it's very complex to model. It is not very straightforward due to the lack of observational data. We have from low redshift, we have data set from ALMA-like observations, but at high redshift, we don't have data particularly for C2 or so on. The way we model the signal, so we know the halos, so we can generate the halos, let's say from in-body simulation. And if you want to understand how the star formation, how this forms stars, we can relate the halos with the star formation rate. Let's say halo mass is proportional to star formation rate. I'll talk about it in detail and the uncertainties here. Let's say if I know the halo mass, I can convert into star formation rate. And if I know the star formation rate, I can convert into different line luminosities. Just to show that there are many planned and ongoing experiments, I am particularly part of CCAT that aims to probe particularly C2 158 micrometer line, also O3. We don't know how lucky we are because O3 will come from larger as the frequency is almost double than the C2, so it will come from very high redshift, and probably the intensity will be pretty low as there are very few sources at high redshift. But still, we'll make an attempt to detect O3, and also we'll have low redshift, higher order carbon different J level transitions, and also NASA-funded CRX mission that will mainly probe Lyman alpha, H alpha, and H beta, and also O3, and that will be interesting. And of course, there are other proposed experiments such as exclaim, time, and so on. Now, in CCAT Prime, I am trying to develop a pipeline code that will be used to predict the amplitude of the signal based on varieties of models. I need to include different varieties of model. The reason is that we don't know what is the correct one. And then the question is that how do you want to analyze it? Because the analysis technique will be a little bit different than CMB, though to some extent they are estimators, they are kind of, they can be compared, but they can be connected with each other. But otherwise, we need to come up with new algorithm to check that which estimator is giving us better information. So in the code is LIMPy, line intensity mapping in Python. If we have the inputs, I can generate the power spectra of lines based on halo model, or I can pass a halo catalog. And if I pass a particular star formation model, it will paint those halos and it will make line intensity maps. And then we can analyze these based on a particular instrumental noise from a particular experiment. And by using different methods, I can construct the parameters. Now, the aim of this LIMPy is basically to generate the maps of different lines from redshift around approximately very low redshift, which is around 0 to 10. Of course, we don't have data set at high redshift, but try to use different models to get an idea that what will be the amplitude, including the uncertainties as well. And we need to do it quick, because if we want to do map level analysis, we need to have many simulated maps that can be generated very faster. And all these maps we need, because here the foreground challenges are a little bit different. As I showed, that lines from different redshift can come into the same frequency channel that we call interlopers. So we need to get rid of these interlopers to get a particular line from a particular redshift. And that is the main challenge here. Now, what are the uncertainties in modeling? So if I am asked that what is the one quantity related to the galaxy formation that I want to particularly know, that will be this messy quantity, which is star formation rate. The reason I call it messy because it depends on halo mass, it depends on redshift, there is complex star formation rate astrophysics, feedback processes, and ISM, different ISM physics, which I am not an expert. But just to show that what are the challenges and how these uncertainties can bias the interpretation of the signal if detected. So let's consider one panel, for example, Z is equal to one. Here, these dot points, these dot scattered points are the star formation rate of halos that I have inferred from TNG-like simulation. So this is from TNG-300 simulation that is done with the, done in box size of 300 megaparsec. So you can see that if, let's say, I fix the halo mass 10 to the power 11, still I cannot say clearly that what will be the value of star formation rate. It can be, it's more than one order of magnitude larger. The scatter is one order, the uncertainty is one order of magnitude. So there is a scatter. So I cannot come up with a particular theory just to model. But again, I can do it always analytically or empirically, which is called halo abundance matching for technique. And on top of it, I am kind of showing different predictions, the analytic formulas, basically that how they go all together. So again, so in LIMPI, I coded in such a way that I can use different models just to check that how these star formation rate changes with halo mass and redshift.
Points from?
So these individual points are individual halos, and that I have inferred from TNG-like simulations, and these points are the star formation rate.
So the points are TNG, but then you have curves for TNG. So which one?
What's the difference? Okay. So the thing is that this is scatter, and as I cannot use this scatter point, so I took mean of this that goes with the best fit kind. I took some narrow beams in mass, and then I took the mean. So just to come up with an analytical curve, so that I can use it in LIMPI I can pass the star formation rate model basically.
Okay, so the second question is why do these become flat at low masses?
So flat in low masses, in a sense, it is not flat. Actually, it is quite scattered. The reason is that all these cases, we fix the minimum mass of the halos is 10 to the power 10. So all these mean things I am fitting above 10 to the power 10, and I'm assuming that below 10 to the power 10, this is the same as 10 to the power 10. The reason is that all the resolution we expect from secret-like experiments, we don't expect we'll go below 10 to the power 11 even. Yeah. So that's why we just keep it fixed. Even we did the same thing for high mass also, like after 10 to the power 12, if there are few halos at high halo mass, it is quite scattered. So I cannot basically infer a concrete physics from it.
Thanks.
Welcome. So once I have this, let's say I fixed one star formation rate, any model, I fixed it. I assume that model is the correct one. But then the problem is that what will be the luminosity of line? That will also vary at different redshift. How the luminosity of particular line corresponds to the star formation rate. And there are also different models. Now these models work reasonably well at low redshift because we have ALMA data, and if we have a plot, it usually goes power law, like with some offset. So like power law, which you can see that alpha and beta. Sorry. But again, the scaling relation can be different if we have high redshift observations. So kind of we tried, that's why we used different models, and you can see that the solid line is the when halo mass, minimum halo mass is 10 to the power 10 and the dashed lines 10 to the power 11. You can see that different models also don't agree pretty well. There is also more than one order of magnitude difference in even if I fix the star formation rate, just because of different model is giving me different line luminosities. There is a scatter even, there is a huge uncertainty in line luminosities. Now, how does this uncertainty transfer into the power spectra? So these things are calculated by using halo model-like approach. So if we can write it analytically, there will be clustering term and sort noise term, and the clustering term will be amplitude of the matter power spectra. So basically, if I know the matter power spectra, I can scale it with any line power spectra just by changing the amplitude and sort noise. So which is basically A and B parameter. Now there are again different models. You can see the amplitude can vary as at 7.4 and 5.8 around 2 or for 7.4 the uncertainties are 2 order of magnitude. And that's why probably it is interesting for to me that we can probably, if we have observations, probably we can just rule out some of the models that don't match with the data set. And we expect that CCAT prime like experiments will observe C2 more than, again, this is probably a little bit optimistic, more than 30 sigma or so. Why I'm saying it is optimistic, because nobody has done the analysis like CMB experiments, including scanning scan strategy, beam, all the forecast we show by using the instrumental noise only. So how we want to analyze the data, I'll come in a while, that is also a big concern. Now, same thing, just to show that same thing we can do for O3, CO76, different lines from 0 to 10, but again, they are also different models and so on. Now, what about the simulations? So this simulation is also done using LimPy. So what we did, if we see the row-wise, all the column, this is a map of C2 that is done 400, so 700 megaparsec box, which transferred to 476 megaparsec by MPC by H. And you can see that at 7.4, there are less structures, there are a few sources, but as time passes, there are more sources. And also we can see the clustering properties has been increased. Now I can do the same thing for oxygen 3, which is the middle panel. I can see, and also the CO76. Now, if we check, for a particular column, all these signals are coming at a particular frequency. So if I set the frequency to 20 gigahertz, I expect that I will see the C2 from 7.4 that will follow this structure. I'll see the oxygen 3 from 14.5, and I'll see the CO76 from 2.65, because those frequencies will be restricted to me at 220 gigahertz. Now, if I have 280 gigahertz, if I have 350 gigahertz, I can see in the same way. What I mean by see differently, actually, I'll not see differently. I'll see the sum of these all intensities coming from different redshift and that are due to the different line emissions. Now, the question is that what we can do with this in this situation. So there are some interesting things which I am currently focusing on. One is we can do limb cross correlation. So I have two different frequency. One is 220 gigahertz and one is 4110. I have two different lines. So 220 gigahertz, I'm using C2, and 4110, I'm using O3. But as they are coming from the almost same redshift, so the underlying dark matter density on the underlying large scale structure is same. So the expectation is that if I cross correlate these two things, they will be highly correlated as they are probing the same underlying large scale structure. But if I cross correlate with other lines or other line emissions from other redshift, they will not cross correlate. So that is one interesting fact about limb cross correlation, and that will be also helpful to minimize the interloper contributions coming from different redshift. Of course, we can cross correlate with CMB lensing as they have a broad kernel, but the problem is that how do you want to get rid of the large K parallel mode? We need to probably do some kind of reconstruction, and also at low redshift, as we have CO emissions, I can cross-correlate with galaxy surveys. Even at high redshift, probably not within 5 years, but as WFIRST like experiments aim to probe more than a million galaxies beyond redshift 6, if I have a C2 map from that redshift, I can cross-correlate with the galaxy surface at high redshift as well. And some of these things are basically the work in progress. The last thing I want to talk about that the data analysis strategy. So here, what we traditionally do, we have a box, we simulate any quantity, let's say 21 centimeter observations or even galaxy surface in this box, galaxy population in this box. And what we do, let's say if we have 80 megaparsec box, we take the 3D power spectra, we do it Fourier transform and then Fourier transform conjugate. And then if I have any function, I decompose it into kx, ky, kz. And when I take the 3D power spectra, all the statistical properties under Gaussian approximation is encoded in this P3D. And I can see the where the power spectra peaks and where it falls. And I can, by using that, by observing the amplitude and shape, I can interpret this signal accordingly. But in line intensity mapping, we have a survey area, which is, let's say, 16 degree square. But as I can scan along the redshift axis, then the redshift axis, the scanning length will be much bigger. Let's say if I scan it from redshift, let's say 3.6 to 7.6, x-axis, the length will be larger. So I can kind of imagine it's a rectangular box. Now the question is that how do we want to analyze this so that I can extract the maximum information? So as I worked on CMB, the first attempt I made just to try to see that if we can separate it if I can analyze it into different CL, and then I try to recombine it to take constant on my parameters. So what we did, we have a frequency, let's say I'm scanning over a broad frequency range and I have a frequency resolution. It means I cannot resolve the sources beyond this delta nu. So when I will make a map, those will sum up all the sources, intensities, or whatever quantities I want to construct, and they'll sum up. So I will see different 2D planes along the z-axis. And the growth of structure is happening along this redshift axis. So if I check the back panel, that will be less structured. If I see the panel in front, that will be highly structured. And that is the one thing that we have done. We have reconstructed this line intensity box into different CL. So now CL will be function of different redshifts, CLZ1, CLZ4, and so on. We did the same thing. We, for a particular instrument, we just did simulate a noise simulation. As you can see that this is the white noise, the power spectra will be flat. And when we combine these two things together, this is a preliminary result, but what we have found that analyzing the line intensity box into different CLs give better constant than we get than the constant we get from P3D. And again, we are checking it, but the reason what we have found, because in this treatment, we are kind of assuming all the CLs are independent of each other. So when I sum the different Fisher matrix, they are independent of each other, so they can break degeneracies. But when we do the P3D, I'm kind of isotropizing everything around the cabins. So probably I'm losing some of the information. Of course, there are other methods that we are working on just to check that what is the optimal estimator. For example, taking PDF of this map. And so we want to do the map level analysis. We want to take how the PDF changes. If I do forward simulation, if I change the parameters by measuring the PDF of a map, if we can construct some of the parameters and also nearest k neighbor, which we have just started to work on. Now, what do we learn from it? So of course, as I said, that we can learn from astrophysics and cosmology, but The thing is that there will be always from the perspective of the plant line intensity mapping observations, it will be highly degenerate. The astrophysics and cosmological parameters, they will be degenerate because it depends on how well I'm modeling the astrophysics, as there are not very tight priors on the astrophysical parameters. But just to show if we take an optimistic scenario, we know that we are going, there is a Hubble tension. This is a value of H, and the blue is, I don't have probably, okay. The blue contour on H parameter, this is H, and in x-axis, it's actually sigma 8. I just zoomed in here and adding a line intensity mapping data for second generation experiments just to see it can improve the values of this parameter. We expect that this will tighten the constant on even the cosmological parameters. But the thing is that, again, it depends. I'll be a little bit skeptical in a sense that it depends on the how well we can reduce the uncertainties in the astrophysical modeling. Same for the astrophysics, which is we are more optimistic in a sense that we'll be able to construct the star formation rate density over a broad redshift range because we have different lines and can do tomographical analysis. So that will also give us information about source of reionization, ISM, star formation rate. On the other hand, as I have the line intensity mapping observations, I have information in 3D and I have tomographic information, I can cross-correlate with different probes such as CMB and galaxy surveys. And as I can probe the structure formation tomographically, I can make an attempt to resolve some of the tension. For example, particularly the sigma 8 tension is very interesting to me. And if we can detect the signals over a broad redshift range using few lines, we can actually probe the sigma 8 with a different redshift beam. We are working on also that how to do noise simulation. So if we have a heat map of a particular telescope, if we have white noise, how this white noise will scan, how this white noise will appear based on a particular scanning strategy of telescope. As you can see this in the middle, the noise is very low because I have more hits there and so on. So I will end up with my conclusions that from CMB side, we will be able to make a template of optical depth. And also it will be interesting to see that different analyses we can put together from constant from KSG, CL tau y, and so on. We can also make we will be able to constant also some of the parameters related to the astrophysics of reionization going beyond the optical depth. For example, tau Chidari and the mass of the halos, escape fraction, and sizes. We can cross-correlate with line intensity mapping to understand the structure formation along the redshift axis. And also, it can help us to break degeneracies between some of the parameters. And also, this cross-correlation can help us to separate the low redshift contribution and high redshift contributions. So I'll end up with this last slide that all the structure formed from a homogeneous CMB at redshift 1100, which proves underlying almost homogeneous homogeneous density fluctuations. In green zone, I am showing that how line intensity mapping observations can probe the different epochs of reionization. Whereas in blue zone, I'm showing that how CMB and galaxy surveys can probe different epochs of reionization. And they can relate with each other by doing this cross-correlation. And in CMB, we are kind of operating third generation experiments and are looking forward to fourth generation CMB Spolak experiments. But whereas line intensity mapping, we are still in first generation experiments. So that's why I believe that next 5 years will be very exciting to work on or to relate these both fields. So I'll end up here and I'll happily take any questions.
Okay, great. Yeah. So thanks, Anirvan. So why don't we all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great.